The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Every day I went to the Tribune and put my heart out there, just like you do at the Sun-Times and how you did years ago at WIMD. You put your heart out there, you put your soul in it. But I had to think with my head. I had to think for my family and for the future.
Hi, everybody. I'm Fran Spielman. My guest this week is former Chicago Tribune columnist John Cass. You are my worthy former City Hall competitor and my forever friend. How are you?
Fine, Fran. I'm great. It is great to be in business for myself and having left the Tribune. And I think one of the first columns I wrote as in my new life, I credited you for that great story on the bizarre compromise Lori Lightfoot offered. What was it?
DuSable Lake Shore Drive hybrid, which is bent down again, by the way, that compromises. I was just about to say to you, anything new going on in your life? Any big changes?
Oh, man, a lot of big changes, Fran.
I'm kidding, first, of course. Your professional life has just changed immeasurably. Last week, you wrote your final column for the Tribune and ended an extraordinary, I think it's 40-some-odd year run that saw you go from a reporter at the Daily Calumet to City Hall reporter against me, to political reporter, and then to the Tribune's page 3 columnist, replacing the late, great Mike Royko. How and why did you decide to take the buyout and join so many of your colleagues exiting a newspaper that is now owned by a hedge fund named Alden Capital?
It was time, Fran. I had hoped to be the guy to turn out the lights there. I loved the Tribune, my time there. I loved competing with you. I loved our many years in the City Hall press room, where we'd squabble and fight like brother and sister every day, Fran. You and your family, loved you and your family and still do. Betty and I still do, and of course. I left because they offered the buyout. I figured either I take it or, if I don't take it, well, I have to look out for my family. So I started a new business immediately. Actually, I started it before I left. And when I left, I linked to it. It's a new website called johncassnews.com. And happily, just the other day, Tom Bevan of Real Clear Politics linked my story, my column on Lori Lightfoot, to his national site. And that's what I'm doing now. I haven't stopped working, Fran. I'm like you. If I don't work, I die. You know, we have to keep moving like sharks. So I'm doing that.
So was this your choice, or did you feel that a company known for cutting the heck out of newspapers, whatever newspapers it buys, would be headhunting for people like you and others if you didn't take advantage of this one-time offer?
I never thought people would hunt for me if I didn't take this offer, but I rationally, every day I went to the Tribune and put my heart out there, just like you do at the Sun Times and how you did years ago at WIMD. You put your heart out there, you put your soul in it. But I had to think with my head. I had to think for my family and for the future. So I think I made the right decision. And I would suggest that many who followed me in the buyouts were thinking the same thing. You know, you have to think with your head. And by the way, everybody, I've watched Fran interview people, mayors, governors, and now she's interviewing me with the same pointed questions. It's really unnerving, Fran.
Oh, I don't mean to do that. Well, I'm trying which mass exodus is bigger, the one at the Trib or the one at Lori Lightfoot City Hall?
Well, I left on good terms with the Tribune. I never would trash my old newspaper. And nobody had to write me an email with, I need office time 16 times in a row. You know, 16. She's melting down, Fran. She is melting down.
It does seem that way based on what happened at the city council, and we'll get into that. But all kidding aside, John,
this is
really a sad time for Chicago journalism, isn't it? A time when watchdogs are needed more than ever. There are dramatically fewer of us. Do you worry about what will become of the Chicago media in general and the Chicago Tribune in particular?
I worry all the time about the people of Chicago without experienced journalists to know what to ask. You know, you and I have broken in a lot of kids in our time, helped them along, but it's cover City Hall as you do, Fran. It takes years and years of watching just to begin to cover it. You have to know which aldermen are doing what and how they're doing it. And I think that the loss of perspective will be devastating. You know, look, I'm just one guy, but the loss of perspective in general as the old models shrink is dangerous and devastating for the people, because we're going to go through a period of time. Now we've mentioned that Lori is melting down. She's inexperienced. We're going to go through a period of chaos, political chaos in Chicago coming up, upheaval, and reforming the city. And as a result, I think the people of Chicago need journalists who know what the hell they're talking about and know what they're doing to sort of help them see the future and what's coming. And without experienced people, God forbid, Fran, I just want you to keep working forever, because people need you. Your readers need you to cut through all the noise and nonsense.
And you and I both know that Chicago politics is a continuum. Things do not happen in a vacuum. There is seldom anything that happens that hasn't happened in some form before that needs to relate back to it. And the problem with young reporters who don't do their homework and don't care to ask the questions is that everything is viewed as a one-off, and it's not.
It's not a one-off. What you wrote today and what you will write tomorrow, what I wrote yesterday, what I will write tomorrow, is based on years of standing in corridors back in 1983 during the council war period. We're waiting for Eddie Verdoliak to come out of the office and talk. It's based on years of chasing Bert Nateris down the stairs when he went before the grand jury to talk about Freddie Roddy. And it takes years to know what the game is and how the game is played.
But
and it's not a one-off.
You haven't missed a beat. You've started your own website. You write in columns just as you did at the Trib. You're still doing podcasts, I believe, right? And you're posting them on the website, right?
I'm doing at johncastnews.com, We're posting podcasts, my columns. We're just starting to learn how to work that website. We've got a lot of subscribers. And
how many do you have, and how many do you need to make it?
We have tens of thousands right now of subscribers, email subscribers. I think the number is 35,000 dedicated email subscribers, and I can't tell you how many page hits. I don't know what all that means, really. I write and I report. I don't know about how websites work, but the web designers at Yellow Box were just amazed that the day I left and wrote that last column for the Tribune was Friday, which I still think is one of the most read things in the newspaper today, you know, online. We launched the johncastnews.com the same moment that I pressed the button. We pressed the button and released it the same moment that the column came up. So it was good timing, you know, good business timing. And for that, I have to credit my good friend and yours, Tom Serafin, who told me, you know, the way Serafin thinks, you have to have a plan. You have to have a plan, John. And so I had a plan.
Is the plan to sell advertising on this website? Will you be charging subscribers? How will it work? How will you make a living at this?
That will be determined, but I assume it'll be some hybrid of both. Plus, I do the podcast that's on the website. Plus, I'm in meetings now with various broadcast entities to continue, you know, talking to the people in Chicago. So I think they might want to hear what I have to say. So lots going on. And it's when you go into business for yourself, it's even it's exhilarating and exciting, and I'm totally pumped for it.
Yours has been, and I imagine will continue to be, a conservative voice at a time when some people believe there is a cancel culture that doesn't tolerate dissent. Do you worry about that? Did it make you a target, or did it increase your audience and embolden your followers?
Fran, you remember what happened to me last year. That was a most difficult time when not the Tribune itself, but some colleagues in the union defamed me as an anti-Semite, as a religious
bigot. Which I know is not true, by the way.
Yeah, I would think that you would, if Mark Eisman were here, he might testify for me, and so many others stood up and wrote pieces in real clear politics.
Why did they think that? Why did they think that? Because of George Soros? Is that what happened?
I think what happened generally is that I offered a dissenting voice. I am conservative, and the reason I became conservative is because I covered City Hall for like, you know, so long, 20 years, and I saw how government works from the inside. And it really bothered me. And so then I'd written a column about Kim Fox and State's Attorney Kim Fox and her financial backing. And I linked to the Wall Street Journal, the Philadelphia Inquirer, USA Today, many newspapers. I linked to them and referred to their reporting. The Sun-Times reported, I think Tina reported, or I don't remember who wrote the story, that Soros gave $2 million to Kim Fox. So I put all that together because he was building, he was supporting prosecutors, local prosecutors in various states, New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, of the Kim Fox variety. And by that, I mean let them go, you know, catch and release prosecutors who aren't really prosecuting, and thought that was that would be a significant issue down the road, which it is, as you see by the street crime and people getting out of jail and on electronic monitoring and shooting each other after while they're on electronic monitoring. So I wrote that column, and I think I can't speak to the minds of those who disparaged me and defamed me, but I think that they didn't like the fact that I refused to join the union. They repeatedly asked me to join, and so they defamed me.
It had to be a devastating blow to have to be stabbed in the back by your own colleagues.
I wasn't happy about it. But you know, we move on. So I moved on.
So let's talk about the conservative voice, though. Is it in danger?
I think in newsrooms across the country, New York Times, even the Wall Street Journal's newsroom rebelled against their fine editorial board. You see it all across the country, just the way people see it in the schools with critical race theory being taught and all this other stuff being taught. So it's come out of the universities and it's into the newsrooms. And I don't think that most of the people, the American people, are one way or the other. I think they appreciate voices that are outside the collective. I've never been someone to go with the herd, and I hate being herded, and I know you do too. I don't even know your politics, Fran, but I know that you don't want you you. I know that you see how people are herded through emotion and trigger words and so forth. And I refuse to do it. I refuse.
So does that make your website more popular because this voice seems to be disappearing from newspapers?
I don't know, Fran. I hope so. I hope that's part of it. But even back in the day when I was at City Hall and realized what Daley was doing to the city and how he was hollowing out, he and the clique were hollowing out the city, and you see the result of it now, where they spent and spent and spent money that they didn't have, and now there's no money to spend on vital programs, and more and more of the city's the taxpayers' dollar is going to the debt service of things that were done in the past rather than taking care of the people's needs today. So
yeah, and selling off assets like the parking meters and the skyway and the downtown garages, so we have less money and less assets to deal with the major pension problems and everything else that we've got.
Right. Back then, when I was writing that, and I think I in the column, putting my, in my opinion, offering that about what we're talking about, Daley and his crew were screaming that I was, against the city. I was trying to hurt the city. I wasn't trying to hurt the city. I was trying to help it. But it is what it is now.
You did a wonderful profile of Richard M. Daley for the Tribune Sunday magazine leading up to the 1996 Democratic Convention in Chicago. I call that the Redemption Convention, when everything went perfectly. The weather was perfect. Daley tried so hard to erase the ghost of 1968 that had so haunted his father. What do you remember about that piece you wrote and the insight that it provided about who Richard M. Daley really is?
A little inside baseball here. Two things were going on after I wrote the piece. One was that many of the restaurants were hurting for business. The one that wasn't was Gene. It was Steve Lombardo's place, Gibson's, right? And the girls at the bar, the conventioners going out. But what do I remember about that piece? That Daley gave me access. We had like a love-hate relationship, and as you know, but Daley gave me a lot of access, and I was the character of Daley. We were standing at the elevators, and he had just had his people take out Ted Lechowitz, the former Dan Rostenkowski aide, who was Democratic committeeman of the 32nd Ward, I believe. And Daley was at the elevator, and Ted was there, and Ted looked at Daley. You know, he had been vanquished, and he smiled and said, well, you know, he nodded to Daley, hello. And Daley turned to him and said, how do you feel, Ted? How are you feeling now?
Oh, boy, that's cold. Wow.
Yeah, there's a lot of cold stuff in that column about, I mean, that it I think it made, I think it was a Pulitzer finalist. Of course,
yeah,
I've never
it was so insightful, showing just how just cold he could be and what a bully he could be.
He was a bully. He was cold. I think he was friendless from the time. I think he was friendless. And I've told this to Lori Lightfoot back when we were talking often. And I said, Lori, you know, at least Daley, for all his faults and manias, had people around him who could tell him no. There was Tim Dignan, as you remember.
But then he became so closed in after all the corruption and contract cronyism that all he had was Jackie Hurd at the end, really.
Really at the end. But when he had Dignan and Joyce around him to tell him no, no, Rich, you're
and
not going to do that.
Yeah.
And Eddie Bedore, he was sailing high. He was at least giving the people some sense that he was running the city competently. And I told Lori Lightfoot that she needed people around her who would tell her no. And she seemed to listen, but then I realized later that she had no one except maybe the hard progressives that she fell in with. And no, they wouldn't tell her no. And you see the result. All mayors.
The Daley administration was dogged by corruption and contract cronyism, hired trucks, city hiring, minority contracting scandals, the HDO, controlled city hiring, a parade of people went to jail. Daley and George went from a little known law firm to Chicago's preeminent zoning attorney, but like magic, Daley's son, Patrick, had a secret chair of a city sewer contract. His nephews dined at the trough of city pensions. Tim Dignan and Jeremiah Joyce got rich. What was it about Daley that made him so tone deaf to corruption?
The outward appearance or the what they sold of him was that, just like they sold his father, was that he wasn't about the money. He was only about power. But as we see from history, I don't think the Daley's ever, you know, I don't think the Daley's had to work at Walmart when they retired, you know, as greeters. There was a lot of money coming in, right? There's a lot of money coming in. They, you know, all these deals, Finkelstein became, what was that? What was that? What is that huge development? Lincoln Yards, right?
Yeah.
All this stuff, all this stuff was an inside play. And I give Lori credit, and to an extent, and to Rahm, that they didn't play that game. But Rahm was his own advisor. He was his own press secretary. And that was his fault. I mean, because you need reporters and columnists need editors. I need editors, Fran. So maybe I'll ship my column over to you when I write it so you can check it out. and mayors also need someone to tell them no. And Lori Lightfoot does not have anyone to tell her no, and she is devolving into a puddle of, I don't know, what is it? Like some, like, nerves and anguish and anger, and it doesn't serve her or the city well.
Yeah, let's talk about her and what happened at Wednesday's city council meeting, leaving the rostrum, getting in the face of Alderman Jeanette Taylor when she didn't get her way on her corporation council appointment, Celia Meza. Lightfoot seems unable to turn the other cheek. Does she have the leadership skills to be an effective mayor of Chicago?
In my column, The Incredible Lightness of Lightfoot, that's on johncastnews.com, I was told to keep saying this, is that I say she does not have the leadership skills. She does not have the political skills. She does not have any of the attributes you need to run a city. And she does not have a self-understanding of her limitations. So we're seeing a collapse, and the sad thing for the people of Chicago is that they're going to have to go through this. And then when whoever comes to take her out, it appears to be Arnie Duncan is coming along, being promoted quietly as the savior, the white knight, if you will. I don't know who's going to take the job, but whoever does is going to go into a system that has been crushed by Lightfoot. And there's also other things going on that are important to the people of Chicago. They don't care who the Water Reclamation District Commissioner is, but they care who the state's attorney is. And I remember Lori Lightfoot had released David Brown to attack Kim Fox last year. He would hold news conferences attacking the prosecutors, if you remember, saying they're not doing their job. Judges aren't doing their job. And then she turns around and endorses Fox, which was a cynic. And I thought, and that was the break with me. I was like, wait a minute. What are you doing? But she did. And that's when we broke.
And her relationship with the FOP, there's a 4-year wait for a new police contract. There's a tidal wave of police retirements. Homicides and shootings and carjackings are up from the record high levels of 2020. What will it take to turn that around?
It will take, like a Herculean effort to do that. It will take a mayor who has sense. You know, she came on early on when she came into office. She had, I don't even know if she still has Klomsky around her, but then she was always with Klomsky, who they're all pro teachers union. And she decided to fight she wasn't going to fight a two-front war. So she picked the teachers union and gave them everything. She gave them the richest contract in America. She protected them. She gave them money. She gave them money we didn't have. And she fought at the same time to boost her progressive cred. She picked a war with the police department and with the police union, which I thought was the wrong thing politically. It was the wrong thing for the people of Chicago, because what do people want? Pick up my garbage and let me feel that I'm safe. I don't think the people of Chicago feel they're safe. I just had a friend of mine call me. He's looking down on Michigan Avenue. He said, it's 9, right before your show. He said, it's 9:30. I'm looking down at Michigan Avenue and it's a ghost town.
Lori Lightfoot a one-termer? Is she? Don't you? For sure?
I think she is. Do you?
It is looking suspiciously that way. Can she turn it around? What will it take to turn it around? Is it too late?
As I said in the column that I just wrote after leaving the Tribune, what she'd have to do is to do a 180-degree turn. She'd have to use her lawyer skills and her word games and her facility with language when she's not swearing at someone or screaming at them to turn it around and support police, give the police support, give the police a contract, and stop the wildly, left. Attitude towards police. She's defunded them without, she hasn't actively defunded them by making speeches.
Well, when you close out hundreds of vacancies, you're kind of doing that slowly.
Cops, look, you walk up and down Michigan Avenue and you see police cars there with their lights flashing. No cops are in there. It's scarecrow policing. She's taken police from the neighborhoods that they're needed and brought them downtown. She has detectives working patrol. Detectives have to be clearing murder cases, not working patrol. She's doing all this because she's at least 1,500, perhaps even more, short in terms of manpower on the Chicago Police Department. This is ridiculous. This is insane. And what you have when you overwork 12-hour shifts, no days off, police during the summer, with when they don't have, they don't feel the mayor has their back, cops make mistakes. Now, a reporter makes a mistake, we misspell a word or conflate a fact. Police make mistakes. They have guns. I just don't understand how a responsible person can look at her and think that she's doing the right thing for the city.
I have to tell our listeners before we go that when you and I were covering Richard M. Daley, there was a day I will never forget when you
came to my defense,
literally and physically. You came to my defense. Would you like to tell that story or should I go first?
You should tell it. I want to hear your
version. No, I want to hear your version. Go.
All right. So I got in. It was a council day, and at city council days, right before the council meeting, groups would come in and make their pitch on issues, all variety of groups, the bird watchers, the environmentalists, the homeless. And that day, a group of homeless people and their activists or advocates came in to address the city hall press room, and they'd stand in the middle of the press room. My desk was opposite yours, about 10 feet, maybe 15 feet apart, facing each other. And everybody, when you know there's a story when Franny disappears behind her desk when she's on the phone and she drops, you know, you can't see her face.
Yeah,
Under the desk. And then you know, geez, she's got another scoop, another Fran Spielman scoop. So homeless activists were in the press room, and I'd gotten in there late, and they were just leaving. And a few were hanging around and insisting to talk to Fran some more. And it was we were all trying to get our work done, write our early city council stories. And I said to a guy, you know, sir, we do this all the time, and you're welcome. Please, we want to hear what you have to say, and we're welcome. You're welcome to come back again, but right now we're busy. We have to get our work done. And then you said something, I don't know what, but, you know, if you haven't noticed, Fran is a tough, tough woman, okay? She's no milk toast. So she may have said something, and then the guy did not like what she said. And I said, look, sir, we'll talk to you again. Please come in next week or tomorrow or the next day. We want to hear what you have to say. And you said something to him, and he said something to the effect of, I'm going to take my gun and pop off a couple rounds in your head. But he didn't say it that way. It was rather vulgar in street talk. And I was standing in the middle. I was standing in no man's land. I didn't have a desk to turn around. And then he left. He walked out the door. And then he came back in, like he just turned and came back in the door of the press room. And he was he reached for his waistband And I thought, okay, I'm in the no man's land here. And as he was coming towards you, everyone ducked. Everybody else, I think Cameron had a heart attack. Bill Cameron, Bob Crawford, and those guys were scrambling.
And John Cass leaped over his desk, tackled this guy, and tumbled out into the hallway defending me. And for that, I will be forever grateful. You showed me what character you have, what a good person you are, and that will stay with me always. And people need to know that about John Cass. That's who John Cass is. He's a man of honor and courage and decency, you are a mensch. Everyone Thanks, needs Randy. To know that. And Thanks, tell us the name of your website one more time so people can hit it and become part of your subscription base.
I want you to join. It's called johncastnews.com. You go there. You can give your you can subscribe. It's free. Everything's free. The column's free. All the content is free now. And you can subscribe by giving your email, and we're putting together the website to notify you when things, you know, when things change and new content is added. It's a great challenge. I do love it. And I'm so excited for johncastnews.com and for the ability to talk to my good friend, Franny. You know, Fran, when I got that guy out the door and we were struggling, I didn't want to hurt him. I mean, he was bigger than me, but in those days I was much thinner and fitter. And I was covering up and saying, wash his hands, wash his hands, wash his hands. And I took his hair, and I just wanted to put him down to the ground gently. So I took his hair and gave him a leg kick, you know, a sweep to just get him off his feet. And he had so much hair product on his hair that my hand slipped off, and I was like, whoa. And I fell to the ground, and he was on top of me. And then Bo and Danny, the coppers down the hall, came running. I was like, "What took you guys so long?" And they walked. They said, "We're going to go for a." I think Danny said, "We're going to go for a walk, sir." And I didn't know where they took him.
John Cass, thank you so very much for joining us. I wish you the very best of luck on your new endeavor. And I'm going to be watching with interest to see how you do. I bet you're going to be a huge success. You're already a huge success. And we will see you all next week.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.